Well, I think we've got all the speakers assembled here, including one person who's going to be via Skype.
Hi, Shweta, do you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay. So I'm just going to, we're going to have an intimate little group here today. The main thing is, I think the idea was to have feature all of you who have gone on and done all these, been intrepid travelers across the different places and come back to report on it, thanks to some funds from the Seeger Center. And I am Deepa Olapalli. I'm the Associate Director of the Seeger Center and a Research Professor of International Affairs. I teach on South Asia, mostly. So what we're going to do today is, and thank you all for making the time to, you know, come to this and report back. Some of you also, as you mentioned, written blog pieces and so forth. So this is kind of, I suppose, the culmination from our point of view of your work, but obviously for you all, it's just maybe the starting point of further work that you're going to be doing, so you can come back once it's all done and you're published and you're back, then we'll have a different kind of a seminar for you. What we're going to do today is we'll have four of you speaking for maybe about 10, 12 minutes so that then we can really, since we're so small, we can just have a conversation. And we'll just go down the table with Rongtian Han first, and then Jiangai Jap, and then we'll turn to the Shweta, who'll join us by Skype, and then finish off with you, Shirkan. Let me just say, just a slight introduction. Maybe you all know each other. I'm not sure, but if not, let me just say, Rongtian Han. He's from the History Department. He's a PhD student. I think all of you are PhD candidates. You are doing work on modern East Asia and strategic studies. Specifically, his research is focusing on the strategic history of modern China and Japan. So that's a very big topic. I'd be interested to hear about what your specific research, your dissertation will focus on.
I'm still a PhD student, but hopefully we'll turn a candidate in a few weeks.
Alright. Well, this is an important time for you. You shouldn't be taking too much time here then. Alright, well, we'll follow that with Jiangai Jap. She is in the Political Science Department. And her research, she is working on ethnic politics, national identity, local government, and Myanmar politics. And so she will tell us what her dissertation is about on the ethnic minority situation in Myanmar. She has won the NSF Graduate Research Fellowship, and she has received support from the Cosmos Club Foundation. That's a very fancy place. Do they give you... Do you get to go to their events at the Cosmos Club?
They did, yeah, but I couldn't make it.
Oh, that's too bad. Highly recommend it. It's very nice. Anyway, congrats. And of course, you did some work with me as a graduate research assistant, so you've been at this for some time. And then Shweta, who is joining us from Assam, which is way in the northeast in India, and she's from the Department of Anthropology, and she's looking at the anthropology of religion, science, and the environment, focusing on a particular island in the Brahmaputra River. And then, last but not least, we have Pichir Pant. She is a doctor of public health candidate. And so she's coming from the Milken School, and she is looking at the intersection of health evaluation, data, and information communication technologies, which is why you knew about the technologies that we were talking about. And she is... with a focus on vulnerable populations such as immigrants, refugees, and women and children. So she's currently looking at a case study in Odisha, in India, again in the East Coast. of India. So, with that, let's start off with
sure.
you. Dantana, do you have a presentation?
Yeah.
A slide, sure.
Yeah. Thank
okay.
you.
All right.
Yeah. Thank you for the warm introduction. So, you've said that my interest is a bit broad, but actually my main expertise is mainly in military strategy, so a lot of military history, but in other groups study strategy, also some other knowledge in economics and politics. So to begin with, my talk today will be about the CCP's military strategy in the war against Japan from 37 to 45. To narrow down a bit, because it's still a very broad topic, I will mainly focus on the New Force Army and East China Theater from 41 to 45. So my talk will begin with the overview of CCP's military strategy in the war against Japan, and then we'll talk about how the research experiences in mainland China and Japan, Taiwan shape my understanding and questions of the CCP's military strategy. So we mainly talk about the experiences in mainland China, because it turns out that the experiences in Taiwan and Japan is not particularly useful for the New Force Army and the East China Theater. And then I'm going to emphasize that the findings now are only preliminary, and actually I raise more questions than conclusions. So to start with, an overview of CCP's military strategy in the war against Japan. So we can actually, in general, break down into three periods. The first period from 37 to 40 is a period of expansion behind front. The CCP conduct both guerrilla warfare and conventional operations, because in this period, the Japanese still didn't pay a lot of attention to CCP, underestimate them. So the military pressure is not that large. So they expanded very quickly and conduct both guerrilla warfare and conventional operations. But from the period of 40 to 43, begin with the 100th Regiment offensive in Fort 40, the Japanese realized that CCP is a big threat, and therefore they dramatically increase their military pressure. And as a result, the CCP during this period have to prioritize surviving Japanese attack and conduct mainly guerrilla warfare and actually avoid fighting conventional battles with the Japanese. The third period from 47 to 45 is again a period of expansion, because from 43 the Japanese situation in the Pacific was worsening increasingly, so they transferred troops from the war behind the front in China to the Pacific theater. So the military pressure decreased again, and therefore in this period the CCP expanded again, and it also reoriented strategy towards a balance between guerrilla warfare and conventional operations. So as you see that during these three periods, there's very clear emphasis on guerrilla warfare. Although in the first and third period, there was talking about conventional operations, you see the really emphasis here during the whole period was on guerrilla warfare. And actually that's how we historians and public understand the CCP's military strategy in the Sino-Japanese War now. I will discuss later that when I went in the archives, I think it's a bit complicated, but that's what we understand CCP's military strategy now in general. So the focus is on New Force Army and East China Theater from 41 to 45. So for this talk, the only thing that you need to know is that the region I'm talking about is mainly about two provinces, the Jiangsu province to the north of Shanghai and Zhejiang province to the south of Shanghai. So as I assume that most of you know where Shanghai is in China, East China, I will not go into the details, but the just some brief knowledge of the geographical location of this talk will suffice. So the first archive I went to in China was the Jiangsu Provincial Archive. And unfortunately, this archive is not very open about pre-1949 CCP history. So I was only allowed to see the files of one particular military region in central Jiangsu, the central Jiangsu military region. But this military region was significant because the forces in this one was one of the two main force divisions in the new force army, the first division. So even if I just allow to see one region's fires, it actually gave me a lot of information about the CCP's military strategy. And what I found out is that, interestingly, local commanders have very significant degree of freedom to implement the strategy. To begin with, that they have the freedom actually to decide the balance between main forces and local forces and militia. This is important because the balance of forces actually decide how you balance between conventional operations and guerrilla warfare. The main forces, they were concentrated, they were regular forces, were used mainly to conduct conventional battles, whereas the local forces, militia, they were dispersed, and they were close to a population, and these forces were mainly used to conduct guerrilla warfare. And this means actually in the implementation of the strategy, the local commanders have a lot of freedom to choose conventional battles or guerrilla warfare. So although we have this general timeline of the change of CCP's military strategy, it's very important that to look at the local conditions, and actually they can shift between conventional battles and guerrilla warfare quite often, and it doesn't really fit into the general timeline. And what I discovered more interestingly is that at this local level, this great emphasis on the importance of main forces and conventional warfare, despite the in general the emphasis on guerrilla warfare. So here's one fire made by the 3rd Brigade Staff Department of the Central Jiangsu Military Region about 1 year summary of the Japanese mopping up operations. And this document is very clear emphasis on the decisive effect of main forces in breaking down Japanese attack. And there's also point out that effective functioning of militia forces actually when in combat actually depend upon the allocation of main forces units to those guerrilla units. So actually this raised questions about how did the new force army really reconcile this emphasis on conventional battle with the overall strategy of guerrilla warfare. And how did they actually fought these conventional battles, and what lessons did they learn? These questions have literally not been discussed in the historiography because our understanding is that the CCP fought guerrilla warfare. But the archive show that it's more complicated. And the second archive I went into was the second historical archive, China, in Nanjing. So this archive is much more open because the sources in it is mainly about the Nationalist Army records. And these records actually shed interesting light on the CCP-KMT conflict behind the front. So as you may know that in the Sino-Japanese War, although there's in general, both the Nationalists and CCP fought with the Japanese, there was large-scale conflict behind the front between CCP and Nationalist units. And one of these battles of Huangqiao and Caodian in 1940 is actually involved about 10,000 troops on each side and result tens thousands of casualties on each side. So as early as 1940, there was already large-scale conventional battles between the CCP and KMT. And moreover, the Western Zhejiang campaign in 1945 was even of larger scale, about 30,000 troops on each side, and the casualty was also very high. So when I was studying, actually, these campaigns from the Nationalist point of view to use their records, actually, I can glean about the strengths and weaknesses of the CCP army's operational capability. So what I see is that the Nationalists point out both strengths and weakness, but they emphasize actually on strengths of CCP's army to conduct operational conventional operations. And the sources I used was the battle reports of Nationalist army units and what war diaries of those units. And we see that the Nationalists was actually very honest about the operational strengths of the CCP units. They were very strong in close combat, night combat, physical strengths of soldiers actually, support of populations, and interestingly in the last category, improvement of the equipment. Actually, nationalist troops pointed out that in 1945, the equipment, the quantity and quality of equipment of the CCP units in the New Force Army was almost the same as nationalist non-normal nationalist units. The only problem they have is lack of ammunition. So they have a lot of guns, a lot of machine guns, a lot of mortars, but not enough ammunition. And this again re-corroborate our findings before that the CCP army in the Sino-Japanese War have great emphasis actually on conventional battles. And here we see that they were actually very effective in conducting conventional battles. And this again further raises the question of how did the New Force Army fight and learn from this various experience of conventional battles. They fight conventional battles with the Japanese, with the Chinese puppet forces, and with the nationalists. And how do they incorporate these various lessons? And also, because the Western Zhejiang Campaign in 1945 was so close to the incoming Civil War in 1945, and the Civil War break out in 1946, so very close in terms of timeline. And also, if you look at the Civil War in the Jiangsu province in 1946, you will see that the same units, nationalists and CCP units, fought in Western Zhejiang in 1945, fought again in Jiangsu in 1946. So it's a great continuity that you can observe in this region and in this time period. So how did these experiences in the end of the Sino-Japanese War shape the CCP's military strategy in the Civil War? So I think it's also a very interesting question. Lastly, very brief talk about the experience in Tokyo, the Institute of Defense Studies at the Department of Defense. So it's great sources in this archive, very open. However, I discovered that most of the sources were on the 8th Loot Army in North China rather than the New Force Army in East China. So not particularly useful for this research, but if you're interested in the war behind the front in North China, it's a great source place to check. And here are some of the examples of the sources. The one on the left is the recollection materials of a particular unit, one division in this case. The one in the middle was the recollection of individual officers and soldiers. And the one on the right was the actually study conducted during the war by the Japanese army about the cases of the fighting of their fighting with the CCP forces. And lastly, the experiences in Taiwan, again, not very encouraging for me because, as you know, that the conditions of sources there were getting worse for mainland Chinese. But there's one place that is still open, the Institute of KMT History in Taipei. This place actually finds more materials about Civil War period, and especially about the KMT's perception of the CCP's military and party. But overall, this place is not really helpful, and they were experiencing some funding crisis, so they were only open 3 days a week. And there's a talking that it will close down in the near future. So if you want to see something, go there as soon as possible. So in conclusion, I think my experiences raise interesting question about the CCP's military strategy in the Sino-Japanese War. In particular, how it enabled local commanders to adapt to specific conditions while maintaining control and coordination. And also, how did the CCP incorporate the lessons from various types of operations? And in particular, how did they conduct and learn the lessons of conventional battles? And also, I want to say that it's a great opportunity for researchers to engage with East Asian societies in general to visit various places. and please apply to this funding opportunity.
Yes, I agree. All right, thanks very much. Let us then move next to Jiankai. We'll move westward, which is next to China and Myanmar.
Okay, I'll just speak from here.
Yeah,
that's
sure.
fine. Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. So I'm working on a dissertation project now, and this was sort of the first leg of my field dissertation research. I study what's called ethnic minorities' attachment to the state. Attachment to the state defined as how these ordinary citizens, their sort of emotional, bond to the to their country of citizenship. And so, in other words, their attitudes towards the state that they're living in. And so when you're looking at these, and ethnic attachment to the state is typically measured as pride in your country of citizenship, right? So in the survey questions, people typically ask like, oh, how proud are you to be an American? How proud are you to be a citizen of Burma or something like that, right? So this is how it's typically measure. And when we look at the survey data, what we find is that ethnic majority in a lot of countries, the politically dominant group, right, ethnic majorities tend to feel more attachment to the country than the ethnic minorities, right? And that's expected. So for example, in the US context, right, the whites, they have more pride in being American, according to survey data, than others. In Russia, the Russians. In Burma, the Burmese, right? So this dichotomy, it's interesting, but that's not the main thing that I'm interested in. What to me is really interesting is that there's this wide-ranging variation within the ethnic minorities. So if you look at the American context, okay, the whites have the most pride in being Americans, but if you look at the minorities, it's ranked as African Americans having higher pride than Hispanic Americans, than the Asian Americans. In other contexts, similarly. And then in Burma in particular, so Burma in the past, because the country was closed, the survey collecting survey data wasn't possible, but since 2011, things have been more open, and so things have been more possible. So in 2015, they collected Asian Barometer Survey collected responses on these questions, and what we find is that yes, the ethnic majority, the Burmese, have the most pride, but within the ethnic minorities, you have Karen, Rakhine, Gaya, Chin, Shan, then Gachin, right? So the question is, in general, what shaped ethnic minorities' sense of attachment to the state? And secondly, why has the state been more successful in winning over a sense of attachment from some ethnic groups than other ethnic groups, right? So why? How can we explain this variation? And the conventional wisdom has been something along the line of power sharing. And the existing research shows that evidence for correlation of relationship, right? So ethnic minorities whose co-ethnics are sort of in the national level executive branch of the government tend to feel more pride. But the question is, like, how does that link happen, right? How does power sharing actually allows, compel ethnic minority citizens, right, to feel more attached to their country? And I look at this, with this sort of bigger picture in mind, and I conduct my research in Burma. And what I argue, sort of my working theory, is the title of my project, which is the need to bring power sharing down to the streets, because everyday experience of ethnic minority citizens, particularly them going to local government offices, these interactions that are considered everyday interaction with the states, they primarily shape. How these ethnic minority citizens view the country that they're living in and their attitude towards the state. And so to better understand this, two basic descriptive things that I needed to better understand. One was, what is everyday interaction with the state in the Myanmar context, right? And secondly, these Everyday interaction with the states are happening at the local level of government. So secondly, what is even the local government in the Myanmar context? So to better understand this, I spent 10 weeks in Burma, and I was primarily based in Michina, Kachin State. Kachin State is one of the ethnic minority states in Burma. It's the one that's located the most up north, and Michina is the capital city. So I was based there, and I conducted 21 focus group interviews with ordinary citizens. So within Michina townships, that there are about 28 wards. Wards are the urban zones in the township, and the village tracts, which are the rural zones. So there are about 17 rural zones in Michina township. And so from 28 and 17 different types of zone, I randomly selected a few and conducted the 21 focus group interviews. And secondly, I interview ward level wards. Wards and village tracts are the lowest level, like the administrative units. So in Burma, the country is divided into 14 states and regions, states being the ethnic minority places, and the regions being where the ethnic majorities are concentrated. And then within the states, it's divided into districts, and the districts into townships, and the townships into wards and village tracts. So this is the lowest level. And so I talked to the general administrators at these level. And lastly, I test run, with research assistant, translated the survey questions that I will run next year in January into Burmese language and the Kachin language. And we did a test run. It wasn't like an official pilot. It was more of a test run for certain terminologies. And so I'll go into a little bit about the two descriptive questions, research questions that I primarily focus on this summer. So with regards to what is even local government in Burma, so in Burma, there are only two levels of government. One is the national level, and the other is the state level. So it's only at these levels of government that the elections are happening. And so the level at which the ordinary citizens are interacting with the state, right? These are all happening at the township level. And at the township level, you actually don't have a government. The offices that these ordinary citizens are visiting, the officials, that the bureaucrats, the officials that they're interacting with, these are civil servants from local agencies of the union level ministries, right? So in the union level, you have a ministry of something something, ministry of something something, and then it, you know, every level that I specified earlier, it just keeps going down and down until you get to the township, the local level. And so the people that they're interacting with, these aren't elected officials. Because like I said, the elected officials really ends at the state level. So just these, the centrally appointed, you know, sort of centrally rotated sort of officials, this is what the local government is in the Myanmar context. And in terms of everyday interaction with the state from the focus group discussions, the main takeaway for me was that the everyday interaction with the state, these are interactions, basic interactions that needed to happen in order for people to just live their normal life, right? So it's not like you're going to, because in Burma, there's no welfare provided by the government. And so you're not visiting welfare offices. You're visiting the township level immigration office because you need a national registration card, which is necessary for you to get household registration document so that you can register your child to government school, or you know, you can apply for a job or something of that nature, right? So people are going into these offices and interacting with these officials only because they needed these basic documents. So these like mundane, you know, interactions that are happening at the very ground local level. And in terms of the test runs, what I'm hoping to do is when I go back, so it's been translated into Kachin and Burmese languages, and it will be translated into Karen and Mon. And then when I go back in January,